Hello, welcome back to Altered States of Context. Welcome officially to season two. Brian and I are here to welcome you into the new season. We have a number of really cool interviews this season already recorded. And I think the format we're going to use is Brian and I are going to record a relatively live episode, once a month, and send you another interview once a month. So that's what to expect from season two here. And Brian, how are you today?
Hi, Nate. Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to season two and happy spring. You know, yesterday here in Portland, it was a very warm day. It was probably the warmest day of the year so far. Sunny, 70 degrees. You know, the COVID restrictions are sort of ending here. People aren't wearing as many masks indoors. So there's a feeling of change in the air, kind of a general feeling of excitement as people are starting to head back out and dare I say, resume quote unquote normal life again.
That's wonderful. It was a beautiful day here too. Nicest day of the year yesterday so far. And so felt really good. So enjoy it while you can until the next wave comes. Oh, I'm sorry, everybody. I don't want to be that guy.
You always are.
It's just, you know, I've tried to given up on trying to guess what's going to happen next anymore. You just enjoy it while you can. While the getting's good.
Exactly.
We ended last season kind of talking about, you know, a lot of the overwhelm and the changes. And we had, an intermission session with, Gene. You know, we kind of talked about some, legalization, decriminalization initiatives, one in our state here of Illinois. And today we can kind of touch a little bit and see where things are kind of a couple months after our last episode as far as news in the psychedelic world and just what we've been up to. Is there any news you wanted to share to begin?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about, you know, what's new in the psychedelic space as preparing for today's episode. And again, coming back to this, it sort of feels cliche to keep saying that, you know, so much is happening and things are evolving so quickly. It's hard to keep straight in my brain all the recent developments. I will share here in Oregon that Measure 109 is proceeding along. We are entering a period of public comment in April where the initial set of rules has been published and the public is allowed to comment and give feedback. That feedback will then be integrated and then there's, you know, multiple steps. But basically, by the beginning of 2023, the hope is that we will be able to really begin accepting applications for, you know, facilitators and licensing centers and growers. So the timeline is sort of that people might not necessarily have access to psilocybin services in January of 2023. That might, the actual time that the public might have access to it might come later that year, but everything so far is proceeding smoothly. There was a little bit of controversy as it was someone, I forget exactly how it unfolded, but there was a movement to disclose conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest of those members of the psilocybin advisory board. And Tom Eckert, who was an architect of the bill and very involved in 109 from its inception, disclosed that he had a financial and a romantic tie to a person at Synthesis. And so he stepped down from his position on the board. So there was some controversy around the idea that
Synthesis is a psilocybin sort of retreat facility that has an interest in expanding into Oregon. Is that correct?
Yeah, they already bought a lot of land. They've sort of expressed that they want to be one of the training programs for facilitators. And yeah, they're from Europe, and you know, they've been running retreats in the Netherlands. We know some of the folks. Nate and I know some of the folks who work there. One of them might actually appear on our podcast at some point in the future. So, you know, Synthesis has been involved in psilocybin work for a while. And I think there's sort of a feeling in Oregon that we want to make sure that what happened in the cannabis industry doesn't happen here. Mainly big players, big money coming in and kind of boxing out small businesses. So there is a sense of we want to make this fair and equitable. You know, my belief is that there is room for Synthesis and there's room for small business. Hopefully these different models can coexist together. But there was definitely some controversy around the idea of, you know, more financially funded institutions coming into Oregon and entering the space.
Yeah, I think the issue with the coexistence comes with a lot of the time that large entities like that, part of their MO is to box out competition. And so that's, and I think the main way they do that is through regulatory capture, you know, and so they kind of get really involved in the rule writing process, which is why it seems like probably really, really appropriate that there was a focus on that and that there was something done about that, because, you know, that rulemaking process is so important. And if it's done to the advantage of, you know, larger interests, it's definitely going to tilt the playing field against the little guy, so to speak, which is how things work in America, you know? And yeah. So I just think there's a whole lot in that. And I think it seems like there are a number of initiatives right now, Oklahoma, Missouri, Connecticut, Michigan, Illinois, New York, Washington, California. Those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head. I honestly haven't been, I don't think I keep track of all of them, but I think in most of them, there is a extended rulemaking process involved in the bill. Colorado has a ballot initiative. I think they have two competing ones that are right now kind of vying for getting on the ballot. And I think all of them call, most that I've seen call for like a 2-year rulemaking process like in Oregon, and that it's that there's so much that happens there, right? There's so much. So I think who gets on that board, who's represented on that board and who isn't is, kind of one of those things that might not get a ton of attention, but really should, because it's going to be enormously influential in how these laws turn out.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so, you know, because this is so new and this is being created from scratch, these boards, at least in Oregon, the way it's playing out, you know, they have to make a lot of decisions about all these different factors that go into what psilocybin services are going to look like. So of course, you know, if someone has a financial interest or connection to a particular organization, you know, there's the potential of bias of crafting the rules in such a way as to favor your own financial interests. And that was sort of the controversy at heart there. But the board is working really hard. I give a lot of credit to the people in those roles having to make these decisions, mm-hmm. having to weigh all of the different, you know, people's interests and different factors, and how do we make it safe? How do we make it equitable? I think they're, you know, my very limited personal experience with the board is that they're really working hard and trying to get this right. And I'm, you know, I think I'm preparing myself that the final product is going to be imperfect. There's going to be flaws in it. And that's just, you know, the natural way of things here. There's no way to avoid that. Yeah. And that's okay. And can we figure out a way to, you know, evolve the version of psilocybin services in Oregon? Can other states figure out how to learn from, you know, our mistakes and continually improve this so that, you know, 2 years, 3 years down the line, we've ironed out a lot of these issues and figured out a way to do this that makes the most sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to ask for a second, Do you hear in the background my hens? Do you hear that? Does that pick up on the?
I do hear like a distressed animal.
Oh,
I'm begging you, Nate, not to cut this part out of the podcast when you edit this.
The only podcast on psychedelic assisted psychotherapy with chickens. They're right outside my window here. They're clucking away.
To remind our audience, Nate is a farmer, and maybe one day we'll do a more focused episode on the intersectionality of farming and psychedelics and contextual behavioral science.
Yeah, I'm working that. I'm trying to work that out in my mind myself, to be honest. So yeah, a lot of states are going to have to go through this same process. Oregon's really blazing a trail and highlighting. And I think that's what's happening right now. Zach Hegney is, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. Apologies if that's not correct. I've only read it. He writes a newsletter called The Trip Report, which is a good newsletter. And in one that he had a couple weeks ago, he had a sort of a graph, like the hype cycle, adapted to psychedelics, in which you kind of see like a huge rise in hype. And then kind of as challenges start to become encountered, it just drops off precipitously, and then after that drop off, things kind of come to more equilibrium. And I think that's a good way to think about what's happening right now, because I do think the hype of the last 2 years was pretty unsustainable in a way. It was just kind of like psychedelics are a cure-all for everything, and they're going to completely revolutionize everything about mental health. And, all you have to do is give people these psychedelics and they'll be better. And I think what we've really seen in the last 6 months is an increased awareness about a lot of difficulties and challenges. I mean, this is hard, and it's going to be hard to get it right. And to balance risks with benefits. I think there's tremendous reason to believe that there are a lot of benefits, and that we're seeing, emerge from the data benefits. And of course we have just tons of anecdotal evidence about benefits, but there's harms too, and there's conflict of interest, and there is, regulatory capture. And we talked in our last episode of season one, we talked a lot about it being co-opted, that those are still risks. And so I think we're kind of in this, they call it that graph called it the trough of disillusionment. Huh. I think there's an overcorrection that can happen there too. Like, everything is wrong. Everything is, it's all hype, is the bubbles burst. And I think that's an overcorrection in that direction. And somewhere in between, we're going to find through a lot of sort of hard work and curiosity and study, and we're going to find the best way possible, the best ways. I don't want to say it the best way, because I don't believe at all that there is one best way. I think there are a lot of ways that are useful. And I think, finding those is what's essential right now. And I think there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah. Along that line, MindCure is a company that, one of the several like multi-million dollar companies that have kind of flourished in the last 2 years. It recently dissolved. And so sort of maybe a piece of evidence of what you're discussing, Nate, that, this is going to crash to some degree. Like, this sort of boom of companies and interest is going to level out in some way.
Yeah, I think it was, there's a number that's floated around. I can't remember exactly where to cite it, and that's okay. But I read that it was a CEO of one of these companies was echoing a projection that was made of the psychedelics being a $500 billion industry. And I mean, maybe, but like, that seems crazy to me. It's like, people are forgetting that we're talking about mental health here. And since when has there been a ton of money for mental health? I mean, that seems like, where's that coming from? It certainly hasn't been a priority up till now. And so now we're going to throw psychedelic drugs in the mix, and everybody's going to want to throw money at mental illness. It seems like a little bit of wishful thinking.
Yeah.
And I think the pharmaceutical companies figured out how to make money off of it by giving drugs that people take daily, but that's not what the psychedelic model is or is likely to be. It's not likely to be able to sell a product that somebody's going to be able to take every single day for years and years and years. So that business model is kind of off the table, I think, in which case.
Although some companies, you know, one of the things that's happening now, last time I looked into it, I was surprised at how much research is being done on novel psychedelics, right? Yeah. Trying to develop a new drug that might be fit more in that kind of regular use model. So imagine a version of psilocybin that, you know, the trip lasts 30 minutes and you could fit into a therapy session. Would that then lead to a model of using it once a week? And because it's a novel psychedelic, the company that designed that version of psilocybin could charge whatever they wanted for it. Mm-hmm. So I think they're, you know, it's really interesting to look into all of these companies putting a lot of effort to try to design, you know, because you could almost say, like, we have LSD, we have psilocybin, we have MDMA, but I mean, that's really just the tip of the iceberg of what the potential is here. And so, you know, in 10 years, what new compounds might we have that might have more advantages and less side effects than some of our current medicines?
Yeah. And there's, you know, of course there's the idea that I think a lot of companies are pursuing, trying to have take one of the psychedelics and basically remove the experiential element of it, you know, like, and that's a real reductionist view of, like, they're, you know, imagining, like, hey, whatever is happening that's therapeutic in a psychedelic experience, it's really just happening in the brain, and the, you know, the whole trip is basically just like an epiphenomenon that's just happening and isn't really essential to the change. It's really about the brain changes. And so they're trying to, you know, engineer a psychedelic without the psychedelic. You know, and then microdosing, you know, developing, you know, sort of optimized chemicals for microdosing. These are all things that people are looking into. Count me among the skeptical on all of it. I mean, whatever, people can, you know, if investors want to throw money at it and if they come up with something useful, good for them. I mean, really, I think that's fine. As long as we've talked about before, none of these companies decide they want to try to lay claim to what's already a you know, public good, such as psilocybin, you know, LSD, MDMA, 5-MeO-DMT, any of these substances that are already in the public domain. As long as these companies leave those alone and don't try to take a piece of that pie, you know, experiment, see what you can find. You know, take the VC money or whatever and spend it trying. I think it's, I'm, like I said, I'm among the skeptical people. I think that what we have is pretty awesome and useful. And I think there's just a lot we can do. I think it's much more fruitful to think through how we utilize the chemicals and substances and plants and fungi that are already available to us. How do we use those? How do we develop protocols and systems around those? I personally think that's a lot more fruitful, but, you know, that's just me. We'll see. We'll see. I don't think there's anything wrong with experimenting with that. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong, you know, with companies who are trying to develop those things. Again, as long as they sort of stay away from the public domain.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I agree with your take on it, and, you know, not to be too focused on economics, though. I mean, it does, you know, this is something that a lot of folks in the psychedelic space are worried about, all of this influx of money. And so why are these companies spending all this time and energy, you know, investing in new drugs? Well, because there's an economic incentive, right? They wouldn't be doing it if they didn't think they could make a lot of money off of it. Mm-hmm. So there, for me, there's that association between new drugs and then that there's going to be some sort of ties to how to maximize profit around that. And so for me, that's one of the reasons why I'm a little resistant and perfectly happy with the tools that we've just really begun exploring, the tools that we already have.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Other news, Nate, going on in the psychedelic space that you...
Well, you know, kind of on this, you know, front of, you know, we have Measure 109 kind of rolling out, and then all these other states are kind of... looking into reform and, you know, the issues that we're talking about. I think that they really highlight and you know, at this point, I'm afraid I'm sort of just beating a dead horse. I talk about it so often. But I think it's something, there's so much, it's a very fractured, the whole, which isn't necessarily a problem. People have lots of different ideas, lots of different beliefs, who are interested in various degrees of in psychedelics. Like there are, you know, people who are interested in it for therapy. There's people who are interested in it for religious use. There's people who have a more anarchist perspective on the whole thing, and that they're, you know, that it should be just decriminalized and nothing else. And there's a lot of different views on it. And that's fine. I kind of, as these are all emerging, I feel like the one thing that I would like to see everyone agree on is that these shouldn't be criminalized anymore. Right. I think I'd really like to see everyone agree that this should not be. And I think there's a little more room for disagreement on legalization or direct sales or things like that. I feel like, you know, then you have issues of commercialization. And I mean, I feel like that's a discussion, but I feel like at this point, there's no justification in criminalization of people going to prison for it. And so that's something I'd really like to see people who are interested in psychedelics pretty much in any capacity. It's hard for me to imagine how you can be interested in any way and also support continued criminalization, unless it's tied to a motive that I think is pretty suspect, right? You know, like it might be tied to a profit motive. It might be in your interest if you're one of these companies that it is against the law still, because then they have to get it from you. And that's not legitimate to me at all. And, you know, if people are concerned about safety, I think we've talked about this at length, how the harms of prohibition, I think really outweigh, you know, potential harms of the psychedelics if they're decriminalized. So I would like to see everyone kind of agree and really push, you know, because the time for reform is happening. Like I said, like I just listed 10 states off the top of my head that are all doing some version of reform. And so I'd really like to see more people interested in this get involved and more people sort of come out of the woodwork and vocalize support for decriminalization. So I'm addressing our audience there for sure. And just, you know, don't be afraid to agitate, to get involved and to try to decriminalize as sort of a, because everything gets better then, right? Like it removes conflicts of interest. Like I think the science gets better if you remove, because I think it's been pretty explicitly stated at times over the last 10 years that, you know, many people view a lot of scientific inquiry, in addition to being learning more about it, as kind of a Trojan horse to kind of normalize psychedelics to the mainstream, to kind of reform drug laws, which to me, that's a pretty noble thing. But at the same time, that's not what, you know, we should be doing science for. You know, we should be doing science for just to learning the best, you know, practices and to be learning, you know, basic science. And we shouldn't be worried about normalizing anything. So I think that if decriminalization happens, that motivation to be like, well, I want to make sure that, you know, we're studying this so that we can kind of further the case for decriminalization, that sort of motivation is completely removed because we achieved decrim. So I think that prohibition makes everything bad. Prohibition ruins everything. So again, I'm going to stop now because I know I talk about this all the time, but I think it's just such a foundation. It's so important. It's so, so, so important that I think that you can't gloss it over. And it really, if you look at any problem, not any problem, but so many problems or difficulties or controversies that we encounter in this space, if you dig a little, it comes down to distortions created by prohibition. It's just such a problem.
Yeah, well said, Nate. I'm curious, since I don't follow this, I think, as closely as you do, what would in some of these bills or other states using decrim models, what happens if you get caught? I know here in Oregon, if you get caught with any drug under a certain amount, right? So this only applies to personal possession. It doesn't. You can still get in trouble if you are selling drugs or things like that, but if you're under a certain amount and you get caught, you're subject to a $100 fine, which then can be removed if you attend one session of substance abuse counseling. And I'm curious what other, and that applies to all drugs here. It's not just plant medicines. I know some states have that distinction between plant medicines and, you know, synthetic drugs.
Well, I think that depends a lot from state to state, and I actually don't know. I don't know the details of all the different state. I think the one in Michigan, I think it's really really heavily influenced by the decriminalized nature movement, and so I think that there's not any sorts of penalties under a certain amount, and I have no idea what that amount is. And I think Illinois is not fully written yet. Like, our law here is, we have a draft of it, right, but it's not been introduced. And I think we're roughly shooting for, there's not really a penalty if you have it in a small enough amount, like personal use. And I don't know, there's of course a limit. Like, if you have, 15 pounds of mushrooms in your trunk, I mean, I don't think that's going to be considered decriminalized, because I think that's politically untenable to do, but I don't know in detail. I certainly haven't followed it. I mean, I'm following it enough to see that it's happening in various states, but I'm not familiar with each state. So I don't have the bandwidth to kind of like get in that level of detail with each state, but every state's doing it a bit differently, the Colorado model is, seems like, well, one of them, 'cause I think two, there's sort of a, from what I understand, a kind of an interesting sort of controversy, not necessarily controversy, but a philosophical difference of opinion in Colorado. There's a couple different approaches, and one is basically just decriminalize everything. Don't allow for any sale. You can't sell it at all. You can give it away. You can grow it, but you can't, there's no sale allowed. It's just all, grow it, give it away, whatever, but that's it. Right. And the other one is more of a everything approach, which is similar to what we've been working on in Illinois, which is essentially saying, like, it's decrimmed. Yes, it's going to be legalized for direct sales. Yes, it's going to be allowed for supervised use. Yes, it's going to be set up to where we'll develop an oversight board and develop rules for psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. So it's like, yes to all of those things. And I think Colorado, it seems like there's two ballot initiatives that are kind of different in their sort of philosophical approaches that are kind of coming forward. So it'll be sort of interesting to see what they do, because I think there's a real advantage in a ballot initiative. I mean, I kind of think whatever Colorado ends, like, it'll probably pass based on Colorado's history with ballot initiatives and drug reform. So I think that has the best chance of any to be the next domino to fall, because just like I said, just because they have a history of ballot initiatives for drug reform doing well in that state. So I think that's the state to watch most closely. Every other state has to go through a legislative process, which is going to take a long time, and it's going to exact, many, many, many pounds of flesh, as it goes through. And, the Sheriff's Association and all these other things are going to, well, we have to do it this way, we have to do it that way, but I think how the ballot initiative gets written gets the signatures, and then it just goes directly to the people. It doesn't have that same process, sausage making process. So I think Colorado is the state to watch. Now, a kind of a corollary here, as we're thinking, cause we we're just learning all the time. It's so new, and there's so kind of wide open space. And I wonder if we couldn't brainstorm a little bit, or just kind of speculate, or just kind of think about, like, well, there are a lot of different ideas about what an optimal sort of like approach would be, and just sort of like what I wonder if we can explore our thoughts about, like, well, what would be sort of an optimal therapeutic approach with this? Because it's interesting, and I think that's what we're here to talk about. So I've been thinking a lot about, I'll tell you something I've been thinking, and then just kind of get your thoughts on it. Like, I wonder, about sort of a model in which the psychedelic sessions were more embedded into simply and this isn't necessarily research, because I mean, there's research protocols that have to be pretty rigid. I'm talking about like just implementing what would work best. And I'm like embedding psychedelic experiences more into a regular course of therapy. So, a therapist can kind of have a relationship and sort of recognize what might be the most useful points to introduce a psychedelic session with a client that they actually know pretty well. And then I wonder what your thoughts are about the idea of referring out for those. Like, if you're the therapist, refer, like, instead of doing that, you know, you're in touch and you're psychedelically informed. You kind of know and understand a bit. You've been trained, but you don't necessarily facilitate that. You know, the person might, you might refer them to a place and, you know, do integrated care. And that place could really be just for trip sitting. I think a lot of the problems that seem to be a lot of the risks are, you know, perhaps mitigated by that. You know, people can go and they can have their experiences, a really hands-off sort of experience. The person can just, you know, it's like Maps always talks about the inner healing intelligence. And if that's the case, you know, if it really is about inner healing intelligence, it shouldn't really depend very much on therapists guiding the session at all. Just let the person have their experience with as much space as you can possibly give them. And then allow them to come back into therapy with a therapeutic relationship that is really well established, to process that after the experience. But the experience itself being really, really, really left alone, like the bare minimal intervention to just provide for basic safety. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think I imagine that there is going to be multiple models of use, right? And mm-hmm. So, you know, I think about the clients that I work with, some of them are going to want to have their experiences with somebody that they have a long-term trusted mm-hmm. relationship with. And yeah. That's going to make sense given their situation. Other clients I could imagine referring out, you know, I think one of the things to think about as, you know, those of us who are interested in doing this work, sitting for people during psychedelic sessions, that it's going to be really demanding and draining. And so, you know, realistically, how many of those can I do a week? Maybe one a week, or I don't know what the best work-life balance would be. And so I imagine if I have a caseload of 30 clients, I'm just physically not going to be able to maybe sit for everybody if that's a large piece of my work. So that there would be some clients where it would make sense to refer out. Maybe they don't need to be with me personally. Maybe there's somebody, you know, a few people that I know that I trust that I could send them to that would be more like that kind of holding space model that you're describing.
Well, and we're talking about them, you know, specifically in the context of treatment and like mental health. Well, it's an interesting, you know, given the name of our show is Altered States of Context, and context is sort of where I always fundamentally go back to thinking about. And yeah, I wonder about if somebody's seeking treatment for mental health, right? Like you want to be able to make, like they're going to need to be supported. They're going to need to be supported before, you know, during, after, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for, you know, mental health support. But I also, does that necessarily mean that a explicitly therapeutic context is that useful for the psychedelic experience itself, right? Like a therapeutic context as far as like before and after, like trying to, you know, utilize that experience to make change. But like during the experience is a therapeutic context in which you have people sitting with you explicitly with the expectation we're going to work on mental health issues. That's what we're here for. We're working on healing. That's what we're here for. Like, is that a particularly good context? I don't know. I mean, this is not tested. There's not been an experiment done. I'm just wondering, like, you could have psychedelics being used with an intention of it being therapeutic without having the context of dosing sessions being overtly therapeutic, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
I know that all the beneficial experiences I've had and so many people I've talked to, like they don't like these really amazing experiences, you know, and I've had that conversation with dozens, if not hundreds of people about like, wow, I had this experience. None of those happened in explicitly therapeutic settings, right? Like they happen naturalistically. They happen. Yeah. And the main ones are, by campfires and at concerts, but there's lots of others. And so I wonder if we would think like this idea that even if we're using it for the purposes of therapeutic healing, does the context of the session need to be therapeutic? What do you think about that question?
No, I mean, I don't think, you know, as a therapist, obviously I'm very interested in using psychedelics in the therapeutic context, but I don't think that's the only way to experience growth or healing from them. I don't think therapy should have the monopoly on psychedelic experiences. I think there's, you know, people who have benefit from trips, you know, in a variety of contexts, whether that's, you know, spiritual or religious or just kind of consciousness exploring. You know, some people like to use these medicines not to to maybe grow or to treat some mental health problem, but just to understand the fundamental nature of reality or consciousness. And they find that to be enriching to their lives. So, you know, the idea of cognitive liberty comes up for me here, and that people should have the right, as long as they're not harming others, to use these medicines in a way that they would like to. And that I would love to see a range of different contexts and options for people to explore.
Yeah. So coming at it from another angle, like, do we have any reason to think a therapeutic context? And I'm not talking about like, okay, so again, there's the broader context in which somebody comes in because like, hey, I have this crippling depression or whatever, right? And I want treatment for it. Okay. Well, right now what we would do, you know, is, you know, say a course of therapy would be something that we would do. And so you're obviously going to embed this person in a mental health service of some sort, right? So they're entering into a context of like, I'm getting treatment for my depression. And then if we're in this world of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, you know, maybe that treatment, that course of treatment would be punctuated with periodic psychedelic experiences. And do we have any reason to think that those periodic experiences are going to be optimized in a setting that we would describe as therapeutic? Like, you have your therapist or two therapists there sitting in a room with the eye shades, with that whole thing, right? That we've come to associate. That's what psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is. Do we have any reason to think that that's particularly useful at all? It's just the way we've done it because it's very consistent with a medical sort of a, like, how we've tended to do therapy. But do we have, not only should there be, I mean, I think we obviously really agree that there should be like, let a thousand flowers bloom generally, but is there any reason to believe that model in itself has merit over any of these others?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one, you know, the one piece that is part of the current model that you'll find in other contexts is the idea of intention, right? Like, that you're going into the experience with a particular mindset, a particular, you know, question or issue or purpose, right? As opposed to, you know, someone who just is at a concert and their friend has mushrooms and say, hey, do you want some? And they're like, sure. And they just pop them in and they don't have anything in mind for the experience. They're like, okay. They don't think about it. Or I'm not saying that that's bad, or I'm not saying that that's any like less worthy, or I'm not judging that, but just kind of comparing that. I think whatever your intention is, whether it's therapeutic, whether it's to connect with the divine, whether it's to understand my consciousness, like when you create a space and you go into the experience with that expectation, that's a particular strong factor that will influence what the outcome is.
That sounds right to me. Although, I mean, I also wonder, I'm like, well, do we know that? Right? Like that sounds right. And certainly, I mean, I feel like it's pretty obvious that the nature of the experience is is influenced by context, right? And, you know, it goes back, you know, the idea of set and setting, you know, a person's mindset or intention would be a big part of mindset going in, you know, and then the actual environment in which they're using it. And we just know so little about what that, you know, what that is, including the fact that maybe somebody going in with a ton of expectation about I'm going to get better. I'm going to heal. I need to like examine my trauma. I need to really open up. I mean, I think we have to include the fact that that's a context that we're testing that we don't know. It could be helpful for some people, but there's also the potential that intention in of itself could be harmful. Like that harm could come of that.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that there's very little that we know for sure. And I think it is an open question. And, you know, we have this model of psychedelic assisted therapy that's been around since the 60s, and it's been the way we've done it. And I think there's a lot of merit to it and a lot of advantages. And because we've been limited in terms of how much we can research, there hasn't been the space for other models to develop.
Right, there really hasn't. And so I guess that's what I'm exploring right here now with you, and I've been thinking a lot about, is just, you know, I think it's important to question a lot of assumptions that we might make, you know, and like, well, this is the way people have done it. Well, yeah, that's the way people did it for like 25 years and then didn't for a while. Like, it's just so little that we actually know. And I think given the, as we talked about, I think so much in season one, given the broad sociocultural use of psychedelics throughout history and given the, you know, first wave of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, and given a lot of the current research, I mean, I think just we have tremendous reason to believe that psychedelics can be of tremendous benefit to the psychological, spiritual well-being of people. I think there's overwhelming reason to think that that is the case. Overwhelming reason to think that that is the case. But within that, it's sort of just a wide open frontier, I think. And a lot of what we assume. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say that the therapy model piece is super interesting to me too, right? I mean, what's the best therapeutic, what's the best therapy model to use in psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, for what people, for what conditions? I think that's one piece of it that hasn't been studied directly. We've been sort of studying the whole package, the mm-hmm. substance plus the treatment, but as research, you know, expands, like there'll be more and more attention paid to the specific therapeutic interventions that are being delivered.
Absolutely. I could imagine a world like just staying within let's go down the acceptance commitment therapy road just a little bit. Like, I mean, I could imagine we'd have to know more. So I am speculating right now. This is just me like playing, right? Like, I'm not suggesting that we know this, but I'm imagining, like, what if we found these processes, like, say, acceptance, right? And we found that, like, you know, you're working with someone and you can kind of see, like, hey, this is where a person's really, you know, really, really kind of stuck in this particular process. And actually, we've learned that MDMA is really good for that one. MDMA is the one. So, like, we're working with somebody and there's a real stuckness here. So, like, an MDMA session would be, like, the session that can help this person move through a place where they're stuck. You know, and we talk about that, and it seems like, you know, like, obviously talk through and help the person we're working with understand, you know, like the purpose of it and how this, we think that this can help. And, you know, or maybe they're, you know, really, really lost in values and being able to take action and, you know, and find, like, you know, that there's some clarity that can be brought to that when people might have a high dose psilocybin session. You know, that can help them, you know, increase, you know, or, you know, just like, so that there's actually more targeted purposes to, you know, based on like a functional assessment. That's kind of an interesting, like, what if we, I think we'd be years and years and years away from that, but I can imagine how, you know, the more we understand, the more it could be kind of really clinically tailored to someone's unique needs.
Yeah, I mean, and throw another thing in there, thinking about combining psychedelics, which is something that is done a lot in the underground and psychedelic communities, you know, like psilocybin and MDMA, or, you know, this one and that one. And I think a lot of people who experiment with that kind of model, we'll talk about the particular benefits. So, you know, you can imagine somebody coming in, a client coming in with a particular set of needs. in the same way that we almost have an algorithm for, traditional psychopharm medications that are prescribed, given this person's symptoms and their history, what does it make sense to start with? And I imagine a day when we'll have more data to be able to make better informed decisions, because I think it's one thing that clients are often wanting from a professional is, what would be the best way to go about this? Like, should I start with a low dose of this, or should I do this? And being able to speak from a place of evidence-based and being able to speak from a place where we know a lot more, I think will be really helpful for the public, because right now, I think people are very confused about what's best for them, or where to begin, or, what should I do microdosing? Should I do macrodosing? Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a wild west out there for the public.
Yeah. And we don't know, we're kind of speculating here, but truth is we don't know. And I think in the absence of knowing, I think we really need to step back and kind of like really examine any assumptions that we might be making. What I was getting at earlier is in the absence of real solid knowledge, I think being very cautious in what we say about it, I think, yeah, we have reason to think this can be beneficial. And, I think to me, we're at a point where I think interventions, especially during medicine sessions, should be as light as possible, because we don't know. If we don't know, then allow it to be what it is, observe it, and maybe over time we can learn more. But we don't need to intervene a lot. I wonder about that too, with, I think, some of the prevailing models of like MDMA therapy, like they're pretty interventionist in the session. I'm wondering about whether that's the way to go, or whether just leaving it really, really wide open. I don't think there's evidence to say either way.
Yeah. There's a need for a lot more research, and it's exciting to see how much is currently taking place. And I think even in another 3 to 5 years, we're just going to have such more, an exponential growth of understanding.
And, in the meantime, learning more about hippie flipping, candy flipping and such. Which hippie flipping, right? Yes. Hippie flipping is psilocybin plus LSD. Candy flipping is MDMA plus psilocybin. I think that's the vernacular, right?
I don't remember exactly, but yeah, we're again talking about these combos that have potentially unique benefits, right? Having the synergy of two different medicines working together.
I forget what something is called. I've never been around this, but somebody described, this was on Twitter, I wish I could remember the name of it, because it was funny, but talking about smoking 5-MeO-DMT at the peak of an LSD trip, and I thought, get the fuck out of here. That's what I thought. I thought, oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's like, if 5-MeO-DMT is a tool that we have, we have psilocybin, we have 5-MeO-DMT, we have MDMA, someone presents with, really severe depression and maybe a trauma history, and what combinations of those different medicine experiences might be helpful. Might be most helpful, right? In treating any individual client's problems. So, I think it's possible that might be where things are headed. If psychedelics continue to demonstrate efficacy, that we're going to see novel applications, especially as they become FDA approved and people begin to prescribe things off label. We're going to start to see more and more potential models of use.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that is potentially tremendous. I just think we're going to have to be pretty conservative, which is funny for me to say in a way, if you listen close, but I don't think it is if you listen closely to what I'm saying, because on the one hand, I'll joke about, candy flipping, hippie flipping, and all this stuff. And I have a lot of wide tolerance for naturalistic use because that, you know, people can do what they want. But I think in a clinical environment, we need to really know a lot more, because then you're sort of prescribing it for someone else. And that's different, because then you're kind of presuming to like tell someone else, like, I think this is going to be good for you. And I think that we just need to know so much more before we can do that. But if people want to go and do that, you know, on their own, it's a free country. At least we say we are. And so people can go and do that, you know, and I think that I have like a really wide tolerance for that because, well, like I said, it's a free country. Also, we should pay attention to and learn a lot from those experiences that people have in the wild, so to speak.
Yeah, agreed.
And then be super, super, super conservative sort of as we're implementing them clinically, and kind of like build our interventions with a lot of care and a kind of a conservative approach, I think.
Well, we are excited for our next season of Altered States of Context. We've, as Nate mentioned, we've got some really exciting interviews coming up, ones that we've already recorded, ones that we're in the process of recording. So we look forward to interacting with our audience. Please feel free to reach out to Nate or myself if you have questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear any ideas that you have for episodes. And yeah, we look forward to the next couple of months.
Yeah. And we're back on. So every other week, expect a new episode. And, you know, we'll have show notes. We have our emails. Also, you know, I've been using Twitter a fair bit. So if you want to interact more, at Tornado Nate is my Twitter handle. Because I really hope we can, and we want to, we're open to ideas, you know, reach out to us. We'd like to facilitate more discussion, more connection, more of a community around this podcast if possible. So feel free to let us know, you know, how you like to communicate, and, you know, where we can sort of virtually get together to kind of make this conversation as participatory as possible. So welcome to season two, and we really look forward to it. We've got a lot of great guests already lined up for you, so we're pumped.
We'll see you next time.